Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always exciting when we can have a morning show conversation about something that we utterly take for granted or do not stop to really deeply ponder. How about something as pervasive, as ordinary as our names? Why is it that each of us is given a name? Why is it that we have a first and a middle and a last name? Why is it that the tradition emerged for the woman when she marries to take on the name of her husband? Why is it that in certain times in our history or certain places in the world, people were identified by one single name, Aristotle? Where did that tradition come from? There are all kinds of fascinating questions to explore about the whole phenomenon of naming. And it is explored so beautifully in a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. The author of the book is Mavis Himes, a PhD psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist based in Toronto. And she has written about this interesting facet of human existence in very intriguing fashion, in part from the perspective of her own Jewish faith. But the book certainly goes beyond that as well, and touches on many, many different traditions and legacies. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's called The Power of Names. And Mavis Himes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the show.
I'm really interested to be talking with you. I think somebody at a glance might be intrigued by the fact that a clinical psychologist is writing such a book. Can you just say a word about how your own professional expertise and field of interest intersects with something like the phenomenon of how we are named?
Certainly. I wear two hats. I wear a clinical psychology hat, and I also wear a hat as a psychoanalyst. And it's really through that door that this book or this topic came to me. You know, we come into this world as no different than animals, in a sense. We could say we're a bundle of biological, you know, nerve endings and anatomical structures. And it's only when we are named, and in fact we are called into being, as I would say, that we become human. And so it's this aspect of being animated and infused with life through our name. We're the only species that names. And it's interesting how when you have a pet, you also name the pet because they become like part of the family and human as well. So there's something about when names don't take, and in my work as a psychoanalyst, I sometimes see cases where the name really becomes a bit of a metaphor for problems, because the name is connected to who we are and to our past, etc. So it's through that, really. Right.
In some ways I have a very unremarkable name, and yet there's something remarkable about it in that my full name is, and probably most listeners to the morning show have no idea, my full name is David Gregory Berg.
Uh-huh.
But my parents, right from the start, called me Greg, and the reason was because they had relatives in Milwaukee with three successive generations of Ronald. And so you had Big Ron and Little Ron and Baby Ron. And even when Baby Ron is a college student, he's still Baby Ron to clarify which Ron are we talking about. And so they didn't want me to be Little David.
But they liked
the way David Gregory Berg rolled off the tongue. So that is my full name. And the issue comes up again and again. And it's just kind of fun. In a sense, I appreciate the fact that there's something about my name that's just ever so slightly out of the ordinary. And I think for me, maybe it's made me a little more conscious of my name, or I think about exactly what my name is.
But what's so interesting and what's so typical in what you're saying is that as soon as I would mention this topic to someone, I would get exactly what you've just done. I would get a story about their name, whether they liked their name, they didn't like their name, whether the history of their particular name. And you also bring up a point that many people are named in certain traditions. The same name becomes, you know, Bob Senior, Bob Junior, Bob the First, Bob the Second, within a family, right? That we're named after some people, after family relatives or people, you know, within one family. In my tradition in Judaism, one can't name someone after a living member, and so you would only be named after someone who's deceased. And in that case, often it would be the second name, the middle name you'd be given of that relative. So it really varies with different cultures, the whole naming choice.
Right. I appreciate that your book, among other things, helps us to kind of delineate the nature of one's first name and one's last name.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That in a sense, one of them is one kind of statement, and the other is a very different statement about, in a sense, who we are and where we fit in the world and fit within our own family trees. Just say
very,
a word about that difference.
So. Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. Because the first name is really the, it satisfies a lot of the desires, expectations, fantasies of what a parent has for their child. So whether it's, I want my child to be so intelligent and named after a famous author, scientist, philosopher, or I want my daughter to be, you know, as beautiful as Elizabeth Taylor or Marilyn Monroe, and so I name her Elizabeth or Marilyn. And parents, I'm sure everyone listening realizes the amount of time and energy that goes into naming a child. And someone recently said to me, boy, it was such a huge responsibility. I was thinking, this little person that I'm bringing into the world is going to have to live with this name. So it's got to be, you know, a name that's so important. So that's the first name. And the second name is really carries our legacy. You know, it's our connection to our ancestors, to our lineage. And it's not a choice. We say the first name is a given. It's a donato. It's a gift. And the second name, the surname, is really, you know, carrying the lineage, as I say. And they each have different kind of psychological valence, really. Mm-hmm.
I like that. You also mention in the prologue something that I think is so important for framing this conversation. You write, most of us take our names for granted, yet our first name, both an introduction and a greeting, is one of the first words we learned. Assigned to us by our parents with love, it is freighted with their expectations and hopes for our future. Our surname, meanwhile, carries our collective history. It is a branding of transmission and affiliation, linking us to our ancestral past. But I love that fact that our first name is one of the first words any of us ever hear. And so in that respect, it is so integral to who we are from the first moment we're outside the womb.
And you bring a very important point by mentioning that, because the first name is given to us. And there is, it's not strongly pronounced in the book, but there is a theme that I feel is important, which is that the name is a house in in which we live, but it's a word that's given to us. It comes from outside of us. And somewhere along the way, through life, our life journey, we have to appropriate that name and make it our home, from a house to a home, to something we inhabit, and that becomes our unique identity. Not only the expectations and fantasies of our parents, what they would like us to be, and not only the traditions of our ancestors, but somehow that we create out of our name. It's a kind of metaphor for who we are, in a sense. So I think that's really important.
I love that. And in the first chapter, which is called An Invitation into Being, I love the, in some ways it's maybe the slightest bit of a tangent, but I don't mean that at all critically. I love the moment you take to talk about an infant and hearing the sound of his or her mother's voice. Mm-hmm. And you write this: soon the infant will scan the musical notes of his mother's voice. These sounds will no longer be only a source of comfort or of emptiness, but also of information and signification. And very quickly, he will recognize those particular and distinctive sounds that form smoothly into a regular sequence. The labels that he hears and to which he responds become repetitive language patterns. And with increasing familiarity, he hears his own name as a melody of sweetness, or at times bitterness, to which he orients himself without hesitation. Conversely, the infant will also discover the power of his own sound. Within weeks, he will begin to recognize the impact of his own voice, his own cries, on the person who hears the cries as a call. The mother, interpreting the sounds of her infant as a demand for food, for comfort, for warmth, responds in haste, in panic, or in time, gradually attributing particular meanings to her baby's sounds. In this way, our little newborn will become a speaking being, a parletre, who will enter the world of desire and determination, drive and enthusiasm. His life will be honored and commemorated, lived with his named presence until its end.
Did I write that?
You did, and beautifully. And but I also love the way in which we think about how our name and our voice are, in a sense, intertwined, and it's difficult to think about one without the other.
Right, and think of how our name is pronounced in different situations. So you've got the voice and intonation of someone who's your partner, your life partner, your husband, your wife, your girlfriend, boyfriend, and how the melody and how those special terms of affection and how they pronounce our voice, as opposed to someone who's a stranger. And I think somewhere in there I indicate that sometimes in conversation, when people use our name over and over, and I gave the example of a car salesman, there's a kind of transgression for me, an overstepping of boundaries, because there's a familiarity in using our first name. We don't automatically use someone's first name. We often, you know, if it's a doctor, or it's a peer, it's okay. But a stranger who says, oh, Mavis, do you like this? Mavis, do you like that? Mavis, do you want? It feels like they're overstepping a boundary there.
Right.
That we don't have that relationship familiarity, and I don't want you assuming that you know me that intimately that you can automatically use my name repeatedly like that.
Right. You talk about the discomfort of a transgression, a line crossed without permission. To use someone's first name in casual conversation is to assume a particular relationship to that person.
That's
we
right.
do not enter such intimacy without implicit permission, nor are we always prepared to grant this privilege to others. Sometimes the familiar use of our name becomes a trespassing of boundaries. And of course, it's important then to understand, not just thinking about that particular transgression or offense, but just the fact that that says a lot about what our name is. I mean, and what our name creates for us.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting. It just made me, it's a bit tangential here, but, you know, in French or in Spanish, other languages, we have the two forms of addressing the you. You know, the familiar and the formal. So it's kind of using, in some cases, it's a parallel to using that very intimate, informal use of the t form instead of the vu, and we usually ask permission. Mm. So I have patients who will say to me, can I call you Mavis, or are you Dr. Hines?
Mm.
You know, because one can't assume that relationship.
Absolutely.
Automatically.
We're speaking with Mavis Hines, who is the author of a new book called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called. I wonder if you could say a word about your own Jewish heritage, Jewish background, which, of course, is a very rich ground from which to draw when it comes to the matter of naming. And, I mean, I happen to be Lutheran, so a lot of what you write about in this book are quite unfamiliar concepts, although some of them are. Mm-hmm. Some of them we share. But I found some of this to be particularly fascinating, the importance of naming within the Jewish tradition. And at one point in the book, you even trace some of that importance back to the whole notion of a wandering people, a nomadic people.
Right, right. So that's a huge question, and I'm going to try and break it down into a few pieces. So my name, which you referred to as Mavis Hines, is the other piece of the impetus for this book, because it started with a certain awareness and working my own personal work on myself and who I am. And my father, who was Jewish, as you mentioned, and was one of nine siblings, seven of which were boys, decided at some point to change their name. The name was Haimovich. So that's a very Jewish-sounding name, and growing up in Montreal, after the war in the 40s, he and his siblings decided to anglicize, shorten the name to make it to fit in more and not to be, draw attention to it. This is a very, very common experience, not only among Jewish people, but all many, many ethnic people who move to a new country and who want to eliminate the foreign-sounding, the ethnic-sounding part of their name. And there are studies even today that show that if you look at a list of people for job applicants or university applicants, in spite of thinking how pluralistic and liberal we are, those foreign-sounding names are less, you know, have less chance of being accepted to the university or the job. So there's still that kind of prejudice when you hear a foreign-sounding name. Mm. So to get back to my story, so my surname was Haimovich. My first name, Mavis, was, I was named after my great aunt, my grandmother's sister, whose name was Malka, which is a Hebrew name. And often in the Jewish faith, we name, as I said, a child after a relative who's died. And because we don't necessarily keep the Hebrew name, because we have a Hebrew name and a secular name, we often name it after the first letter, so M, common to Malka, common to Mavis. But my Hebrew name is still Malka. And that Hebrew name is used in Jewish ceremony, weddings, burials, anything to do with the Jewish faith, any rituals, I would be called by my Hebrew name. My name conceals. It doesn't reveal. When people meet me, Mavis Hines, they have no idea what my ethnic background is. If I met you and I said, my name is Malka Haimovich, that has a completely different resonance. You would know immediately what my background was. So that's why I say the name announces. And through that, people often expect certain things. You know, you meet someone with the name Annie Wong, you expect to meet an Oriental person, and yet this could be the surname of her partner or husband. And so we have preconceived notions just based on the sound of the name.
You know, it's so interesting as you kind of talk about the way in which many names are changed, and often people coming to this country might change their names ever so slightly, and sometimes change those names quite dramatically.
Exactly.
And in many, many cases, there is no way to know exactly what was going through their minds. Was the name changed out of fear, or was the name changed out of a sense of ambition, or some kind of strange mix of those feelings and maybe others? I'd never stopped to think about how a real veil, a really impenetrable veil of mystery, probably surrounds that. Maybe most of the time, we don't know the answer to that question.
Yes, and many names go through transformations. And in your introduction, you mentioned the point that, you know, the Greeks had mononyms. They had one name, and it would be, Aristotle the something or other, or so-and-so the Stoic, or so-and-so the, and it could be a place name, a city name. And then the Romans had three names. But the Western world was mainly mononyms also. It was your first name, and those names typically were biblical names or names that had some relationship to a characteristic. They don't translate well in English. Joy, let's say. So may she bring joy, or faith. Names that had a meaning, right? And then it was only in the 1700s when the pool of first names grew too big, and for taxation purposes, for civil purposes, the government needed to increase the pool of names, and surnames were added. And those who didn't own property, like the gypsies, the Jews, the disenfranchised, didn't have a surname until much later. That came much later. So, and many people, as you say, with these different surnames, want to fit into whatever community they belong in.
Right.
So there's a long history of name changing.
Absolutely.
Name changing, as you say, to hide one's ethnic identity, but also many actors, many, artists, many change their name.
Right.
To sound more sexy.
Yeah. And I happen to be a music professor in my other life, a voice teacher with a background in opera. And one of the most intriguing reasons for an opera singer to change their name, once upon a time, I don't think it happens nowadays very often at all, but once upon a time, there would be American singers who would change their name into something that appeared to be Italian. So a soprano named Margaret Roberts would change her name to Margheriti Roberti.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, exactly.
And right. I think nowadays it doesn't happen because, generally speaking at least, American opera singers are among the best trained in the world. And so, you're proud to be American in that respect at least. And the last thing you would do is change your name to appear not American.
But it's a fascinating phenomenon. Right. And names go through phases, right? We also see that, especially first names, they go in popularity. So the 60s had a lot of hippie names like Dawn and Aurora or, Moonshine or, and then there are trends that, different trends. I'm not sure where we're at now, but I think people now want to search still for unusual sounding names.
Right.
At the time when the pool was Linda, Susan, Barbara, Anne,
I am particularly fascinated by the phenomenon in modern America, in at least certain sectors of the African American community, where in many respects names are created that, at least as far as the parents are concerned, are utterly unique, and that is why they are created. I mean, specifically, so this is a name that no one else has ever had. Lequestrian, or whatever it might be.
Right.
And the more exotic sounding, the better. And I really wonder, and I imagine you wonder too, what is sort of the emotional or psychological hunger that is being satisfied?
Right. What immediately pops in my mind is perhaps the desire to be particularly unique as the name, and yet exotic as well, to kind of carry one's heritage in a prideful way, because if it's African Americans, there are people who've had a long history of, slavery and disempowerment. So a kind of pride and saying, look, this is who I am, And at the same time, a uniqueness that, but pride comes to mind as well, you know, very much. That's off the top of my head. That's what I think of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Part two of your book is titled Burden or Blessing. And of course, it talks about the fact that we feel, as you write at one point, an obligation to live up to our name, be it a name of fame or obscurity. For better or worse, we are all subjects of identification. And so, you know, whatever your, you know, if your last name happens to be Einstein, or if your last name happens to be Hitler, or whatever it might be, but there is this sense that we can be blessed by our name and we can be burdened by our name.
Right.
That's an intriguing concept.
Yes, and I think the burden part can be at what I would call a psychosocial level, like to carry a name like Hitler. I just read the biography of Stalin's daughter, written by a Canadian, and the struggle she had with her name, and at some point she marries and she moves to America and changes her name to Lana Peters. Svetlana was her first name, so it's taking the last few letters, and Peters was Wes Peters was one of her many husbands. So the burden of that weighed at a kind of psychosocial level, but there's also the kind of deeper inner psychological burden of carrying a name that may have been fraught with abuse in one's family, a kind of need to distance oneself from some horrendous psychological abuse, if you want. And so that burden and the need to perhaps be identical. You know, if you carry a Kennedy name or a Rockefeller, there's a whole prescription of how you should behave, as you mentioned. But I think psychologically, it also can be that kind of inner burden to want to create and fashion your own identity that's not so linked with that name that carries such a weight.
Hmm. I want to mention that there's also a chapter in the book, quite interesting, called In the Name of the Father, in which you talk about the matter that is so pervasive of the male name sort of carrying the weight. And of course, we live in an age now where women are not nearly so prone to do that. Or I think of my own sister, who she and her husband, all through their wedding, I mean, during the ceremony, were still quietly whispering to each other about what their married name should be. And it was only towards the very end, before my father, who officiated, was finally told by one of them that we want our last name to be Spencer Berg, hyphenated.
Right.
But, I mean, right to the last possible moment, they were debating amongst themselves, which should it be? Should we hold our own, or what should we do? But
exactly.
Says something about how
huge. It's a very, very, today, you know, or for the last, you know, since the women's movement, I think that's been a huge issue. And that chapter you mentioned, In the Name of the Father, is probably the most psychological chapter for me and has some, you know, interesting concepts in it. But so again, I think there's always the question, who is the father? You know, we know the mother. We know the mother's carrying the baby in her belly. There's no question about who's the mother is. But there's always this deep-seated, unconscious question of who the father is, right? We never know. It's on faith that you think you know who the father is.
Or the result of a blood test that you would know,
right,
but there
right,
is no
right,
immediate
exactly.
visible way to know, oh, yes, this must be the father here.
Right.
Yes.
And even though we know, I mean, women know who the husband is most of the time, there's still this kind of lingering in one's unconscious, that doubt. And so that anecdote that I mentioned in the book where the husband says, or people say, oh, yeah, he's got, you know, daddy's eyes or daddy's nose, it's almost a sigh of relief. Yes, this really is my child. You know, thank God.
Absolutely. Right. And there's so much to think about in the naming that we do in our lives. And my closing thought is my cousins from northern Minnesota, who all have two middle names. And just this morning, I wrote one of them. I said, how come all of you have two middle names instead of just one? And I'm expecting to hear that it's Episcopalian or it's some other, you know, ethnic reason. No, it was that the mom and dad argued about who the oldest child's middle name should be, so they just put them both down, and then they liked the way that sort of rolled out. So now they all have two middle names and beautiful names that they cherish, and it just all that your book, it just sort of spurs us on to think about our names and the importance of naming.
I'm so delighted that you were so taken with the book. That's very comforting and very reassuring.
It's a fascinating book. Again, it's called The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We Are Called, published by Roman and Littlefield, and the author, Mavis Himes. Mavis Himes, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Take care.
In part two of today's Morning Show, we're going to play more of the interview which we began airing last Tuesday with Dr. Steven Ungerleiter, a member of the board of directors for the Foundation for Global Sports Development and a co-producer of a remarkable new documentary film called Munich 72 and Beyond. The film, which aired last week on PBS, talks about the tragic events in 1972 when 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were murdered by Palestinian terrorists at the 1972 Munich Olympics. The film also chronicles the tireless efforts of the families of those murdered in Munich to see the tragedy officially acknowledged by the International Olympic Committee and the victims properly memorialized in Munich. I began my interview by asking Dr. Ungerleiter about the mission of the Foundation for Global Sports Development.
It started 25 years ago as just a small advocacy group to work with young kids, kids at risk, different types of kids from different backgrounds who were struggling to stay in school. And we started looking at how sport could be a channel to get kids back in school and respect for their teachers and mentors and also fair play, ethics, really try and use sports as a metaphor for bigger things in life. And we've grown over the years, not so much in staff, but in the amount of program we've been able to do. And we work all over the country, and including domestic and foreign programs. One of our signature programs is actually taking a group of teenagers, 16 to 18 high school kids, who have been screened and interviewed over a long period of time, to the Olympic Games. And it's not just about seeing great athletes. For example, in London, we had close to 100 kids. We took them to the British Museum, the British Library, Shakespeare Festival, met different political figures, and they got to see, you know, Michael Phelps and a lot of other terrific athletes. So it was the full cultural milieu, and we think it's a game changer. Kids come back and they're doing better in school, and instead of taking a job or dropping out, we're hearing these amazing stories of kids applying to medical school and engineering school, and really looking at life in a different way. So we're very, very proud and excited about the work that we've been able to accomplish.
So help us understand how the Foundation for Global Sports Development, how it aligns with the tragedy at the 1972 Olympic Games. How did you and your organization become so deeply involved in the response to what occurred back in 1972?
Well, two members, David Ulick, who's a corporate attorney at Shepard Mullin in Los Angeles, has been working with me for the past 30 years. I'm a psychologist, and I've done a lot of work in the sports psychology, sports medicine field, anti-doping. I've been involved with the United States Olympic Committee and a consultant to the International Olympic Committee for the past 38 years. Served on different committees, including the anti-doping committee that everyone has been reading about recently with the Russian athletes who were doping and you know the state allegedly state-sponsored doping program. So I've worn a number of hats and been to Rio, and next week will be my 14th Olympics. And like I said, I am involved with lots of different committees and different pieces. Mr. Ulick and I were invited by our new president of the IOC, Dr. Thomas Bach, who took office of the IOC three years ago, and actually knew, Dr. Bach knew the Israelis from his days as a competitor. He was a fencer, a gold medal fencer, and he knew many of the Israelis. And as you said in your setup piece, there's been a lot of radio silence and shenanigans with the IOC and various presidents over the past 44 years where nobody wanted to acknowledge these horrific crimes against the Israelis, the 11 murdered athletes who were taken hostage. And Dr. Bach said, enough of this. These were my friends. These were fellow Olympians. This happened on Olympic soil in Germany, and I'm not going to put up with it, and signed an executive order to build a memorial in Munich, 150 yards from the stadium, which happens to be about 150 yards the other direction from where the Israelis were housed in the apartments where they were taken captive and tortured and murdered. And he said, I'm going to fund it. I'm going to have my executive board back me up, and we are going to hire architects, and we're going to get it done. And indeed, they are on track to open the memorial in early 2017. I was invited, along with Mr. Ulick, to serve on that committee and meet the architects and meet the various delegations who were stakeholders in putting this together. And this is the, you know, Cliff Note version, but there's been a lot of meetings and small stumbling blocks, but for the most part, a great spirit of cooperation with the Israelis and the Germans and the various diplomatic corps. And the memorial is underway as we speak.
Hmm. Can you describe, at least in a general way, what it will ultimately look like if people come to visit it in a general way, at least? What is it that they are going to see and or experience?
Well, let me just back up and say the film was an afterthought. We were flying back and forth to Germany, to Israel, to Lausanne, the headquarters of the IOC, and engaging with all these fascinating people, including the architects and the different stakeholders of the Ministry of Culture, people from Angela Merkel's office. And I commented to David on a 16-hour flight back to Los Angeles, you know, a lot's been written about this, and a lot of people, some people know, but really the next generation and my children don't really know. There needs to be a film, not only about what happened, but the whole reconciliation and the paradigm shift of the International Olympic Committee, and why now, and how did this come about. So fast forward, we engaged a group of filmmakers and we made this documentary, which has been on the festival circuit, and we're very blessed. It's gained some terrific success. But to answer your question, we met with the architects, we interviewed them, and it was a juried competition. Some very, very prominent architects actually bid on the project, and it got narrowed down to six from 60, and we sat in on the design meetings, which I found fascinating as a psychologist, because the conversation was not just about architecture. It was about the architecture of memory and the architecture of grieving and architecture of loss, and how do you put that together in those emotions in a building where people can come in and have a moment of silence or prayer and remember this horrible period, this darkness of terrorism 44 years ago, but also have an uplifting feeling that we're finally acknowledging these families. So when you walk in the building, there will be video screens and interactive to look at the athletes, their background. There was also a German police officer who was murdered. He will be part of the memorial. There'll be a very short discussion of the hostage taking, but more focused on the lives and the families. And now, 44 years later, it's three generations. So we not only interview the widows of the athletes, but their children, and we didn't interview grandchildren, but they were there. So we wanted to, and the architects wanted to present this whole package of history and telling the story and ultimately sharing this information so that, things like this will never happen again. This was considered one of the first acts of global terrorism played out on television. As you remember, and I remember, and some of our viewers might remember, this was around-the-clock coverage by ABC News, and Jim McKay was the anchor, and no commercials, they never broke away, and everything was shot live from Munich as was unfolded. So this will be expressed in the memorial along with the remembrance of the families.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting aspects of this, and I'm not sure that your film actually explores this, but I suspect you might have some thoughts on it, is what the reaction of German officials was back then in more of the immediate wake of this tragedy and disaster, that surely they felt a terrible sense of guilt and perhaps didn't know what to do with that guilt. Can you just say a word about that, about what sort of sense of responsibility was felt at the time and in intervening years by those who, at least in indirect ways, perhaps played some part in this situation being handled so poorly?
Well, I think you're right. There was an enormous amount of guilt and remorse, and we failed, and nobody likes to fail, especially at a worldwide stage of the Olympic Games when millions of people are watching on television. It looked pretty bad, and the facts bear that out in all the investigations that and reports. The German police and both the state and federal agencies were not prepared, didn't have the proper security folks in place, didn't have anything close to what we have today. An Olympic Games typically today costs between 17 and 20 billion, that's B, billion dollars, and over 2 billion is spent on security. So you have a sense of what it takes to put on the games and how many agencies are involved, both at the local and state and federal, and then private security forces who now travel with the teams, and some athletes have their own private security. It's a very sad commentary on where we are in the world, but the facts are security is a big issue. So yes, there was a lot of collective guilt, and then of course the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, while the tragedy was unfolding over a 36-hour period, Israeli agents had to get permission from the German government to enter the country, because at that point there was a rule in place that only German officers and state security would manage the security. And the Israelis offered to bring in special teams, and we know that the Mossad are quite famous for doing pretty amazing rescue attempts. This has been well documented, and they were rebuffed. They were told, you can come, but you have to sit at the airport, and we will monitor your activity. And there's a whole piece that we talk about where the head of Mossad, who we actually interviewed, he's 92 years old, told us that he was talking with Prime Minister Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan, General Dayan, on a landline, because there's no such thing as a cell phone back then, and they talked for hours and hours and hours, but he was only allowed to be an observer. He could meet with a few people, but he had to stay in one room, and he was contained in that room. And he saw this whole thing unfold and reported back to his government that they had their hands tied. They weren't allowed to do anything. So it was very painful. And I think to hear the victims talk about what could have been done to save lives is another painful chapter.
The heartbreak just sort of piles upon heartbreak in this story, doesn't it?
Indeed.
What can you tell us about how the survivors are doing now, given these recent developments, the long-awaited acknowledgement, the construction of a memorial in Munich, and, of course, other efforts that one hopes makes a difference for the better? What is your sense of their emotional well-being? None of this, of course, reverses the events of 1972, nor brings any of these loved ones back to life. What kind of difference do you think it has made in their lives emotionally, or is it difficult to say or generalize about that?
Well, I think it helps with some of the closure. Clearly, now that the International Olympic Committee and the German government have worked with them to have the memorial gives them a sense of optimism, and this will these horrific moments and nightmares will never be erased ever. But at least there's a place to cope and deal and grieve, and some closure can be gained by that. And it also is a place where people can come from all nations. In fact, President Bach has been talking to our team about when it opens in 2017. It's not just an Israeli and German Olympic thing. He wants members from all of the Olympic family, which today is now 205 countries. It was much smaller back in 72. He wants representatives from every country to be there, because this is a moment of Olympic solidarity and letting athletes know, we want to embrace you, we want to make you safe, we want the Olympic movement and Olympic soil to be a place where people can lay down weapons and come together and compete on a level playing field and have fair play. So I think the president and executive committee is making an important statement, and I think it's being well received. I think the Israelis and the victims feel optimistic about the film, optimistic about the memorial. There's also opening ceremonies is Friday, August 5th. We are our members of our team will be there the first week for a number of meetings. But on the 3rd of August, 2 days before opening ceremonies, the Olympic Committee is holding a special service, and they've asked a number of people to come together with the Israeli families to talk about these developments. And I'm told that NBC will be doing some coverage of that. So I think all in all, taking these pieces and putting them together, there is a sense of hope and optimism. And I think the Israelis are and the families are feeling much better.
Dr. Stephen Ungerleiter is on the board of directors for the Foundation for Global Sports Development. Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview originally scheduled to air last week that had to be postponed. Dan Barry, a reporter for the New York Times, and his fascinating book called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in America's Heartland. On Thursday, Nan Calvert will be joining us, and we'll be talking about dragonflies. And on Friday, we're going to be talking with some of the jazz musicians who are going to be part of the upcoming Harbor Park Jazz and Rhythm and Blues Festival here in Kenosha, which is a week from Saturday. The morning show airs